Now we have the FICE project, and I will hand over to Kuma or Yuni.
Hello everyone, my name is Yuni Choi. I'm the project manager for the FICE project, and what we have for you here today is to talk to you about the key proposals in the recently published discussion paper, FICE. And if you have any questions that you want to clarify, or if you want to make any observation on the topics that are on the things that I said, then please feel free to stop and say it. Otherwise, I will proceed. So if you turn over to agenda paper number 5, slide 3, it tells you a bit about where we are in terms of the project life cycle. So this is a research project, which means the board has explored different ways to achieve the project objective, which is to improve the information provided in the entity's financial statements about the financial instruments issued by those companies. And also, this project aims to help solve some of the practice challenges that arise when applying IAS 32 today. And the deep discussion paper has been published in June 2018, and it is still open for public comments, and the comment deadline ends early January next year. And depending on the feedback that received from stakeholders, the board will decide what to do at the next step, one of which could be amendment or replacement of IAS 32, or it could be something else. But everything really depends on the feedback that we receive from you. And what we have included on slide 3, as well as the link to our project site on our website, which is a lot more material about the key high-level summary of the project, to the detailed webcast covering different topics that I am going to cover today. So if you want to find out more about particular topics, for example, presentation of financial liability or presentation of equity instrument, we do have a topical webcast available on our website, which will give you a bit more detailed information. If you turn over to slide number, it tells you about what is exactly in the scope of this project and what is not. And this is one of the common questions that we get from the stakeholder. So this is about classification of financial instrument issued by companies, and it is not about how to account for financial assets or what are the recognition and measurement requirements for financial assets and liability, which is covered in IFRS 9. So we are not reopening IFRS 9. And this project is also not about reconsidering the existing disclosure, which is covered in IFRS 11. Another common question we get is, what would not change as a result of this discussion paper? So we have one of the key ones that we want to highlight on slide number 5. So just to go through them very quickly. So the definition of a financial instrument, which also defines the scope of IFRS 9 or IFRS 7, other financial accounting standards, will not change. So whatever that is financial instrument today will continue to be financial instrument tomorrow, and that's really the scope of this project. And there is no proposal to change putables exceptions, but there is a question in the DP. So if you have any comments about putables exception, then there is an opportunity to comment. But the board's preliminary view as of now is to retain the exception and carry forward unchanged. And also, there is no proposals to change the conclusions in the IFRIC 2, which is about the shares in cooperative and other similar instruments. And also, there is no proposal to change the way in which classification of financial instruments will not be affected by economic incentives and laws and regulation. So this means the classification of financial instruments will continue to be based on the contractual terms specified in the contract, consistent with how we look at it today. On slide 6 really tells you about what we have heard over the years through the different number of consultations that the board have undertaken, and how we are addressing or how we are responding to what we have heard. So what are the key messages then? What we have heard over the years is really IAS 32 works well, especially for simple financial instrument like ordinary shares and simple bonds. If the company has issued those instruments, then they don't have problem applying IAS 32. But at the same time, IAS 32 is a pretty old standard. It was issued more than 20 years ago. And since then, a lot of newer type of more complicated financial instruments have been issued. And for those financial instruments, IAS 32 wasn't always very consistent or didn't give you a very clear answer. So some of the companies found it difficult to apply and resulting in sometimes accounting practice diversity. And there is also a consistent message that we have heard from investors, which is about when something is classified as an equity instrument, we get very little information. So they consistently told us that they need more information about equity instruments issued by companies. So we are doing three things. So one, articulating the classification principle while giving more clear rationale. And second, improving consistency, completeness, and clarity of the requirements. And we are focusing on the areas that we know that there are some practice application challenges when applying IAS 32. And the last piece, which is also equally important piece of the project, is about presentation and disclosure. And because classification at the end of the day is a binary distinction between debt and equity, so it can, no matter where you draw the line, it can communicate only so much information. So the board recognized that, and therefore the board is trying to provide additional information through presentation and disclosure. So if we were to go through those three areas in turn, so I'm going to start with the very first one. So this is about classification principle with the clear rationale. And if you look at slide number 8, and if you remember only one thing from today's presentation, I think this slide should be it, because it really captures what we are trying to do in terms of the classification. So the approach is, if you have issued a financial instrument, then you ask these two questions. And if you answer yes to one or both of these questions, what you have issued is a liability. So first question is, we call that a timing feature, but the question is, can I be required to pay cash or hand over another financial asset before liquidation? The second question is, have I promised a return that I need to deliver regardless of my performance or regardless of how much asset or resources I have? So we call the second question an amount feature. And if you answer no to both questions, then what you have is an equity instrument. I think it's easier to think about actual instruments to test this question, really. So if you move over to slide number 9, we have an example there. So let's say you have issued an instrument and received currency unit 100. And what you have promised is you promised a coupon of currency unit 5 each year, and at the end of year 5, when this instrument matures, then you will repay the principal amount of currency unit 100. So if you were to ask these two questions that we have just looked at, is first question, do you have an obligation to pay cash? The answer would be yes, because you have promised to pay currency unit 5 each year and 100 at the end of year 5. And what about the second question, the return on this instrument independent of the performance? The answer would be yes, because it's a fixed stated amount. So you have answered yes to both questions. This is a financial liability. Second example on slide 10. So you have an issued an instrument and received currency unit 100, similar to the first example. But what you have promised is you have promised to deliver 100 units of own shares in year 1. Let's ask the two questions. Do you have an obligation to pay cash before liquidation or another financial asset? The answer would be no, because it's your own shares. It's not your asset. And is the amount independent of your own performance or your economic resources you have? The answer would be no, because the value of the 100 units of own share will really depend on how well you are doing or how much resources you have. So that is not independent. So you have answered no to both questions. So what you have is an Let's just go through two more examples to make these questions really stick in our minds. So example number three, you have issued an instrument for currency unit 100 again. And you have promised to deliver on shares, but at this time, you have promised to deliver a variable number of on shares so that its value will always equal currency unit 110. So is there an obligation to transfer cash? No, because you're delivering your own shares. But what about the amount feature? What have you promised? Although you are delivering your own shares, you have promised to deliver currency unit 110, which is a fixed amount that doesn't change with your performance or your own economic resources. So the return on this instrument will be independent of you. So because the answer to the second question, this instrument would be a financial liability. The very last example that we have is you have issued a share, which is the same right as ordinary shares, but the holder of the share can come to you and ask for a redemption at year one for its fair value. And if the holder does that, then you have to pay back in cash for whatever the fair value of that share is at year one. So if you were to ask the two questions again, is there an obligation to pay cash? Yes, because if the redemption requests come in, you've got to pay cash. What about the return on this instrument? It is not independent because whatever cash amount that you will have to pay really depends on how much your share price is worth at year one. And that will in turn depend on how you are performing and how much economic resources that you have as an issuer of this instrument. But because you have answered yes to the first timing feature question, this instrument will be classified as a liability.
I have a question. Would on year one plus one day, when that option no longer is there, do you reclassify to equity?
No. So there is no, once you classify a financial instrument as either liability or equity on day one, you wouldn't do reclassification.
So in this case, if that was a one-time option, the mm-hmm. option expired, you would continue to hold it for equity for the next years, or
that's the money you got for the option, which was contribution in the form of equity. You are paid for that option.
Yeah.
So it is got the same. Let's say for a share, you're paid upfront. That's there in equity for, let's say, what we call going concern for 100 years. So that's the same concept that's being used here.
Mm-hmm. So what you have on slide number 13 is the result of applying this two-question approach to classification. And what you will notice on this classification matrix is that there are different types of financial liability. So there are purple liability here on the first quadrant, which have met both, which where you would have answered yes to both questions. But at the same time, you do have a liability. For example, the one in blue, where you only answered yes to the first question, but not the second question. So this is where the board is thinking to use the presentation and disclosure requirements to communicate the differences between these different types of liability. Before I move on to the second section, which will cover classification of derivative and compound instrument accounting, do you have any questions or observation?
And raise your card on the last question. Your card is...
Sorry.
Ian?
Maybe I missed it, but we're classifying these things as financial liabilities, and just to follow on from Sandra's, but let's say the conditions expire. So we're then sitting with a financial liability on the balance sheet. do we leave that sitting there forever, or do we write it off through the P&L, or does it disappear through OCI or something? What sort of happens there?
I think the question that was raised was for equity. For financial liabilities, they will disappear once they expire.
It's debit to financial liability, credit to what?
On example four, if the holder did not exercise the option on year one and that option expired, what's the accounting year one plus one day? Does it remain a liability?
This instrument, let's say in year two, the holder no longer has the option to redeem, but the instrument is still outstanding, whether you would, like how you would treat that?
That's the question.
Just go through the instrument again.
So that's the instrument allows the holder of to ask for redemption at year one for the fair value of this instrument.
Mm-hmm. And is classified as a
liability because of the obligation to pay cash if the holder were to ask.
But I guess my question is, if you just added one more condition that expires, what's the subsequent accounting? It seems odd that it would remain a financial liability when it no longer had the features being a liability.
Okay, can I just understand? So what you're saying is that this instrument is a financial liability, right?
Right.
Well, you're saying that.
Yeah.
we're just trying to clarify the accounting. I think we accept
if it's
for the
a financial
argument, we accept it's we the position is a financial liability, and then in the scenario Sandra's giving, the condition has expired, so you're left with this financial liability sitting on the balance sheet. So what happens next?
That's the question I'm trying to understand. So this is a 1 year instrument. It matures at the end of 1 year.
No. It is an instrument that has a feature. Feature only lived for 1 year. The instrument lives longer.
I think it should be reclassified to equity because, the features that you can redeem.
I don't think that's where the confusion.
For 1 year, and therefore you have issued your shares. So the liability has to be reclassified to equity.
That
but it's not a classification because it is the term of the feature.
It's not. What you're saying is that the other condition exists, just that obligation to redeem drops away.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
So then it remains interest in the shares of the company. So you no longer have the timing feature to transfer cash. That disappeared when the option expired. So then would you reclassify the instrument because it no longer meets the definition of a financial liability to equity?
I think in general, we are not proposing reclassification of the same instrument. If
a liability will be discharged in this case.
That's the triangle. No. The liability doesn't. She's saying it just turns into an ordinary share after 1 year, right? Yeah. The redemption obligation
if he does not exercise his option. This is not the case. In the example four.
Amending example.
You are changing the example. That's what I was trying to understand, is that you have an instrument.
Line in the example that if he decides to exercise the option in terms of converting it into the share.
No.
Let's assume I'm issuing a share to you, and you have the right within the first year after issuance to put it back to me, and I have to pay you fair value. If you don't do that until end of year one, this right to put it back to me is gone, and then you have an ordinary share. So now what is, during the first year, it's a liability. What happens after the last day of when you can exercise the option? Let's assume you don't exercise the option. What is the day later? Does it continue to be a liability because of a non-reclassification rule, or does it now become equity? I think that's
the whole question. What you're saying is on day one, after 1 year, if the option remains unexercised, that's not the example what we're looking at. That's the thing I was trying to, it won't, it wouldn't be classified. As of now, everything is on initial recognition, as of today, even under 32. No. If the terms change, unless and until you resolve that change in terms, results in a derecognition event, i.e. the instrument goes away, you will continue this as a liability.
But the terms don't change. The terms don't change because the terms provided for a one-year option,
in this
and
case,
this term is not changed. It just expires.
It's not the same instrument. It is not, we don't reclassify the same instrument.
That's the
after
point
the 1 year, I think, when the redeem right is gone, I think you have a
that's
different
when you
instrument.
Have an assessment
and this
point.
Instrument is classified then as equity in this example. Yeah. Otherwise, it could not happen.
That's where you have that point where you have to make the call, is that after this thing has expired, is this a new instrument or is it an old instrument that's going on? With such a fundamental term going around, that's a point where you will have to make that evaluation. If you come to the evaluation that it's not the same instrument because such a fundamental thing, then Martin says it will flip back. Flip into equity?
Yeah. We don't flip things. We do debits and credits. So. normally, when I derecognize an asset or liability, it runs through the P&L, but I could be...
You could have a P&L impact, yes.
No.
Very
no.
clearly, if it's a liability, financial liability.
No. This is under IS-32, if you have a preference share that has a period where it can be put back, it's a liability until that expires, and then you reclassify it to equity.
Yeah, man, it could not be a different outcome here.
Yes, for
it
to say that. That's what I'm saying.
But
yes,
go for. Christopher.
Yeah, maybe one quick question. I don't know whether I missed that at the outset.
Mm-hmm.
IFRS 2, yep. How does that relate to all this here?
There is no proposal to reopen IFRS 2 either, so... this project is not about IFRS 2. So just think about it as whatever that comes under IS 32 today, that is the scope of this project.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So IFRS 2 will continue.
It's financial instruments, but not.
Okay, because some of the instruments are instruments that are used under IFRS 2.
Some
but not financial instruments, which are counted currently under.
Definition.
Okay. So that's if we were to move on to slide number 15. So this is about classification of derivatives. And if you think about what IS 32 required today, it has a fixed for fixed condition, but there has been a lot of question about how to apply the condition. And one of the questions asked is about what does fixed mean in the fixed for fixed condition? There has also been a question around different accounting between the FX rights issue and the foreign currency convertible bond. If the same foreign currency option were embedded in a foreign currency convertible bond, why should they be accounted for differently for those that meet the FX rights issue exception? So even for the derivative, the board's preferred approach uses the same amount and the timing feature question, but because the derivative is an exchange contract that has two legs, the amount feature question is phrased slightly differently, but we are still trying to capture the same information about how the timing feature affects the liquidity of the entity and how the amount feature affects the return on the return that entity is making. So if you look at slide number 16, this is the extract from the classification principle from the DP. So if you the part A is about the timing feature. So the question to ask for derivative is this derivative net cash settled? Because that could require the entity to transfer cash. Otherwise, you will look at the amount feature, and the question that you need to ask for derivative is the net amount of derivative? We say net amount because we need to consider the receive and the pay leg of the derivative. Is the net amount affected by any variable that is independent of the entity's available economic resources? And some of the examples that we covered in the DP can be found on slide 17. So we talked about what about the net amount of derivative is affected by foreign currency. report about anti-dilution provision affects the either the number of equity instruments to be delivered or the amount of cash to be received. So how does that affect the classification of derivative? Other things covered are also on slide 17, but you will find more information in the discussion paper and also in the webcast that I mentioned at the beginning. Do you have any question on classification of derivative, or have you had any experience with the classification of derivative that you want to share?
That's interesting. Can I ask a particular thing? Foreign currency rights issue. Have you seen that in practice come up? We're trying to gauge, because we are saying that that's going to be removed.
You should contact the Canadian the Canadian standard setter, because it's quite common.
I spent a week in Canada just recently, so yes, I've been in touch with them.
Okay, that's quite common there because of the dual listing.
Mm. Okay, that's one. Anywhere within any other jurisdiction? And I'm just talking about rights, not the convertibles. That's a different thing that we look at. Okay, that's interesting.
All right. If we were to move on to slide number 18, we wanted to spend a bit more, a little bit of time on talking about written put option on non-controlling interest. And just to recap on where we are with IS-32, IS-32 tells you that when you have an obligation to extinguish your own shares, for example, in a situation where you have written a put option to NCI, a non-controlling interest in a business combination type transaction, IS-32 tells you to do one, recognize the liability for the gross amount that you have promised to pay. And then two, IS-32 says you reclassify that amount from equity. But that has caused quite a lot of questions in practice. What does reclassification in equity mean? Does it mean de-recognize, or do I create another debit entry within equity? And if so, do I do that? Do I debit an NCI, or do I debit a parent equity? What do I do for reclassifying in equity? So the discussion paper clarifies that no change to the liability accounting, so you will continue to recognize the liability for the gross amount that you promised. But second, the DP discussion paper clarifies that you de-recognize the underlying shares. And three, this is a new bit, you will classify the remaining rights and obligation after classifying liability and de-recognizing equity. So if you think about it, what you have done is you have essentially two obligations now. So one, you have an obligation to pay the amount if the counterparty chooses to put the share back to you. So you have that redemption obligation. But you also have an obligation to exchange the redemption obligation with the underlying shares if the counterparty chooses to keep the shares. So in order to recognize that obligation, we are saying you have to recognize a written call option to complete the accounting. So that's where we are. And if the written put option was written for the fair value of the non-controlling interest, then it will be subject to remeasurement requirements applying IFRS 9. But we are also proposing potential separate presentation of income and expenses or changes in that fair value in other comprehensive income, which we will cover shortly. So just to flag that for your Have you had any experience in dealing with written put options in non-controlling interest?
Yeah.
Did you have any problems or challenges?
We had matching puts and calls.
So all right, okay, I see.
Forward.
We found a very helpful section in KPMG's manual, which allows you to do something called the anticipated acquisition method. That's essentially this.
Okay. Essentially, yes. The other point to consider here, one of the proposals is derecognition of NCI. There are some views in the market on that one. This is one of the approaches the board has looked at. So when you look at your comments, do consider whether you're happy with that, happy or you have other views on that, because what's being proposed is NCI being derecognized.
Yeah, we do that. Yeah.
So I don't disagree. A lot of people do exactly what's in the DP, but a lot of people do a lot of different things, in all fairness, because there wasn't much guidance in IFRS on what you do, other than, as you said, recognizing the liability component. And that's very clear. So it's the next steps which the DP has gone and completed. It hasn't changed any of the accounting as such. Absolutely, a lot of people do that.
Okay, so that completes the classification section of the discussion paper. What I'm going to cover next is presentation and disclosure. And for presentation, I want to talk to you first about presentation of financial liability. And at the beginning, I mentioned briefly when we were looking at the classification outcome matrix that we are trying to use presentation to communicate the differences between those different classes of liability. So the liabilities that we are looking at here is the liability that has the obligation for the entity to deliver cash. Well, if you only look at the return or the amount that instrument promise, it really behaves like an equity instrument. So it is linked to equity, or it reflects the maybe changes in share price, for example, or it tracks it represents the return on the residual interest of the entity, just like equity instruments do. So we thought about, like, how can we provide information to the users of financial instruments in the financial statement about this particular types of financial liability and how income and expenses from these liability affects the financial performance of the entity when they are analyzing the financial performance of the entity. So the proposal is, if you turn over to slide number 21, so if you have an instrument that have a return like an equity instrument, the proposal is to present those income and expenses in other comprehensive income, so that the users of financial statement can look at when they assess the performance. They can exclude this type of income and expenses, or at least tell them distinguish for the purpose of their analysis. And the proposal is also not to recycle back to profit or loss, even when these instruments are realized. So based on all outreach we have done so far with the users of financial statements, they like the fact that they will be able to distinguish this type of return from the return from other income expenses from other types of financial liability. But they do have different views when it comes to whether it should be presented separately within profit or loss using a separate line item, or should it be presented as part of OCI. They also seem to have a different view as to whether it should be recycled to profit or not, for various different reasons. So I want to just stop and pause here to see any reactions or any questions on this proposal.
Do we cover FX separately?
Oh, yes. So in this proposal will also cover non-derivative financial instrument, as well as some foreign currency derivative that would be classified as derivative liability just because of FX affecting the net amount. So some of the FX rights issue, although by removing the rights issue exception, they will no longer be classified as equity, they might be getting this separate presentation in other comprehensive income. So that's another part to consider is for this presentation proposal.
So that's why I was asking about the FX rights issue. While the exception is being proposed to be removed, generally the concept is that also to be allowed these for separate presentation. So effectively, there are two elements of the FX, and it also comes in from foreign currency convertible bonds, which are classified as liabilities because of the foreign currency element. There are two sides to that classification which have troubled constituents. One is the classification as a financial liability, but I think the bigger one also, possibly, I shouldn't say bigger, but another big one which I've heard from practice, is that once you classify such instruments as a financial liability, because it's a derivative component, it's a performance of the entity that gets changed, because the better you do due to share price movements, the worse your P&L looks, and vice versa. And therefore, the proposal is to show it separately, which users do like, and it does cover foreign currency convertible bonds under certain circumstances. So please have a look, because there are some gating conditions in there when you get that and when you don't. For certain jurisdictions, this is very, very important. So please have a look and see whether those gating conditions work for you if you think this is important.
And take, let me try in easier words. When if you have this NZI puts, then our proposal is okay to have that as a liability, and if the fair value then offset increases, then clearly liability will increase, and then you have, I think, a debit in P&L because the liability is increasing. But the reason for that is because the value of the company, because it is kind of paid on your shares, is increasing also. And many people find this counterintuitive if the value of the company increases and then having a debit in P&L. But that is our proposal, not avoid this debit, but to present this debit maybe in the P&L differently or move it into OCI. Other people saying, okay, but why should we disclose it differently? Because it is a kind of, if the value of the company increases and if they have to buy back the NCIs, then really they have to pay more cash, which is, I think, then a higher expense. And why should it be different from other higher expenses? That is a question. And it's a little bit like this own credit, where people also think, okay, that if you have that, okay, it's counterintuitive, and therefore present it in OCI instead of P&L, because a company in this credit, okay, is doing worse, and then you have a credit in P&L, which is counterintuitive, but it's a little bit like that here. And therefore we decided maybe, okay, it is, will help me, because also many people which were against this showing this NZI puts as liabilities, because they wanted, because the valuation of the liabilities then ended up in what they think destroying their performance statement, because they have, if they're doing well, they have a debit in P&L which destroys their performance.
That's actually the reason why I asked about IFRS 2, because that's the same thing under IFRS 2.
Yeah,
little. Under IFRS 2, I have, if the value of my company goes up, I have a higher expense in my P&L.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of people find counterintuitive as well, because they say, well, company does well, but the profit shows the opposite. And that's why, if that's a reasoning for saying, let's change it here and push it into OCI, then we would go like on a principle-based level, we apply this principle to IA32 stuff and a very different principle to IFRS 2, and that's what I struggled with. I also struggled, I looked into the cross-references, the very weird cross-reference from IFRS 2 over to IA32, from IA32 over to IFRS 2, with some exceptions in it. Not so easy to identify what falls under one and the other. And that's why we need to be clear that we either go into a world in which we say it's very important whether your liability is an IFRS 2 one or not. Yeah. As I said, number one, that's from a principle-based accounting approach, that's a bit weird to say. It depends on what standard you're under, if the issue, as Martin described, is the same. And number two, then you need a very clear line between what falls under one compared to the other, which with the cross-reference from one to the other, I don't know whether this borderline is
very clear at the moment. So that's maybe something you want to have a look into.
Yeah, so if I were to just summarize what I understood is one is about comments about clarity of the scope. Mm-hmm. And the second bit is the consistency in accounting between IFRS 2 and 32 or the discussion paper approach. Okay.
I would like to emphasize that, in fact, I mean, the way I understand it, the OCI treatment is very much responding to a mix, in fact, a mismatch introduced by the lack of recognition of internally generated goodwill. So if the perception of the content the counterintuitive expense when the liability increases because the value of the entity increases. In fact, this stems out of non-recognition of internally generated goodwill. So it's really one of the circumstances that was envisaged, that is envisaged in the conceptual framework, where you go to OCI in order to, in fact, solve a mismatch problem stemming from different measurement basis or recognition basis for assets and liabilities. I think the IFRS 2 issue that you described, Christoph, is somewhat different.
But couldn't it be the same? Could you also say, okay, because what is the reason why the value of the company is increasing? Maybe it is a kind of internally generated goodwill that was the reason, but we don't recognize it, and then we don't have a credit in P&L and a debit because we don't recognize that, and so we have an offsetting item. Isn't that the kind of the same argument? I don't know. Okay.
Okay. So the next one I wanted to talk to you about is presentation of equity instruments. So this is really to address the investors' feedback that we have been receiving for many years that you have very limited information provided in financial statements about equity instruments. So what we are essentially doing is, because we have heard that people telling us that you shouldn't, IAS 32 works very well for most of financial instruments, so don't change the classification outcome too much. But at the other end, we are getting requests from the investors saying that they need more information about equity. So this is really our way to balance those two different voices. So while not changing the classification approach too much, how can we provide more information? Because when I speak to some of the investors, some of them still prefer the narrow equity approach where only the ordinary shares are classified as equity. So this attribution proposal or presentation proposal is a way to provide the same or similar information that would have been provided if these equity derivatives were classified as a liability without changing the classification. So with that in the background, if you look at what we have on slide 22, so how you will do this attribution. So if you think about what you do currently is you do, if you have a non-controlling interest in a group company, then you will attribute the total profit or loss and other comprehensive income to non-controlling interests and the owners of the parent. So our proposal for attribution is really to expand the attribution to what you currently attribute to owners of the parents to different types of equity instruments. So including, for example, preference shares and options to issue shares or even the conversion option embedded in a convertible bond, and you might have an equity component in the convertible bond and you might have classified them as part of equity. So it applies to all of them, but we are thinking of two different ways for non-derivative and derivatives. So for non-derivative, what the proposal is to attribute the amount of dividends declared or paid on those instruments. And this is actually the amount that you will require adjusting when you are calculating basic EPS per IAS 33 today. So our proposal is just take that amount and then present it on the face of the financial statement so that it can be made more prominent. And our proposal for the derivative equity instruments is slightly more in terms of maybe the level of effort required. And because they are potential ordinary shareholders, if these equity derivative were to convert into ordinary shares, because of that relationship, we have thought about more than one way to attribute, and the board had not reached the preliminary view on which method is the best one, because the board decided to seek investor feedback on which are the method that they will find most useful before deciding the way forward. So if you want to find a bit more about different approaches, you can find the more details in the appendix, slide number 25. But I will not go through the details of each different approaches. But one thing I will mention is the one of the options include the disclosure-only approach, where the companies will be providing the fair value information of derivative equity instrument in the notes to the financial statement, as opposed to the face of financial statements. So what we are doing in general for presentation and disclosure is we are trying to understand what is the cost. What is the cost of preparing these information? Because the board acknowledged that all additional presentation and disclosure do involve cost and effort from the preparers. And at the other hand, we are trying to understand what is the benefit of these disclosure. Is it really useful? Does it help the users of the financial statements? And we are trying to balance them. So our request to you is really, we need to understand from you that what is the cost of preparing these information. And then maybe I can cover disclosure, and maybe we can see whether anybody have questions or observations. So we are proposing three additional disclosures. So one, if you turn over to slide 23, the first one we are thinking of is the priority of claims on liquidation. And by that, I mean we are thinking of something similar to a capitalization table, which some of the security regulators require in the initial offering document of the security. So basically, you will have a table which is similar to the one that is provided on slide 23, listing all the issued financial liability as well as equity instruments of the company in the order of priority on liquidation. But we understand that this information can be quite challenging to pull together, especially for group companies which has different subsidiaries in different jurisdictions. You've got to consider the structural subordination or how they are affected by the local jurisdictional laws and regulation, etc. So we do appreciate the challenges, but users have been giving us very positive feedback about this type of information, because for now they have to do their own analysis based on very limited information. The second disclosure is about potential dilution of ordinary shares, and this is really to provide a maximum number of the ordinary shares that a company might need to issue as a result of the options outstanding or convertible bonds outstanding. So rather than giving in addition to the diluted EPS information, this will provide the maximum number that the users of the financial statement could use for their own analysis purposes. The last disclosure is about terms and conditions that affects the timing or the amount of the financial instrument or cash flow, timing or amount of the cash flows arising from financial instrument, and that will cover both financial liabilities and equity instruments. Any questions?
On the priority.
Murillo, first you. Sorry.
My question is more on a basic level, so I don't know if maybe.
Go ahead.
I found that the approach really clever, so congratulations. I liked it. I think that the current approach that we have under IAS 32 creates a lot of problems indeed. But I was wondering, when I read the discussion paper, I don't know if I didn't pay enough attention on during my reading, but I was wondering how this approach deals with the conceptually when an entity has control over the timing, so I could defer payment indefinitely. The fact that I have something related to that is independent to the value of the entity creates a liability. I conceptually, I can still can control the cash disbursement. So how come does it become a liability conceptually just because of the value of the instrument? I'm struggling with that, so I don't know if you could.
So I think, that's a valid question. And we have heard a question from other stakeholders as we are talking to them as part of our outreach. So, but we wanted to focus on even if the entity has the ability to defer the payment on liquidation, ultimately, even on liquidation, when the entity distribute whatever they have to different instrument holders, still the amount, the contractually specified amount will be independent of the economic resources. But we appreciate, because of the priority of different instrument, that you could, what we can see why you say that, why you question whether it is relevant when the entity has the ability to defer, and is it really relevant to focus on liquidation scenario? Because everything in theory could depend on the economic resources or available economic resources of the entity. But one benefit of our approach, which will look at the amount feature, even if it only arises on liquidation, is it solves some of the problem that we had with the economic compulsion. So, for example, if you had a cumulative preference shares with maybe a step-up feature. So if the entity has the ability to defer it as long as it like until liquidation, but if the entity choose to pay the amount, then the amount will be independent amount. It could be a stated rate of coupon, like 5% of notional, but in the market and everybody, market and the holder of the instrument and the issuer of the instrument, the expectation is that they will pay those amounts. But without considering the economic incentive as part of classification decision, we could not get to the liability classification. Uh-huh. So what I'm saying is one of the benefits of considering the amount feature independently of the timing feature is that it solves this problem about economic incentives and classification.
But I struggle with the concept. Yeah, the concept, because to assume that a liquidation is the point in time you can consider to determine the classification of an instrument, I think it kind of conflicts with joint concern assumptions. And to take into account the fact that, and I know many instruments currently use these features that leverages the step up conditions, and they force the issuer to make these payments. But to take that into account, even though the issuer still has control to decide whether he will pay or not, I think it's still very, very controversial.
Do not disagree that this is a change, and this is what we are calling liquidation focus, which has come in, as you rightly point out. The concept which you're saying, one of the things we're coming back to where the impact is coming in, we think is only in cumulatives. Because if you have a non-cumulative, we haven't absolutely agree with the going concern assumption, that's what's based. So if you look at the DP, it clearly says that the PV of that is negligible. So we don't expect anything, and the discretionary dividends and everything stream for a, let's say you have non-cumulative perpetual instrument. Mm-hmm. So nothing changes. The PV of the principal amount is zero because there's nobody attributes any value, and that's on a going concern basis, because if you discount forever, what's left? Nothing. Yeah. So that is absolutely in the DP, that's accepted. The cumulative bit, we don't always think of liquidation, which is where you don't have enough money or anything. But think what the standard is, what the concept is trying to do, is let's say you have an instrument that accumulates the return which sucks away the return from every other stakeholder in the entity. So even if it's a liquidation, for example, which is voluntary, not planned, but voluntary, mm-hmm. this instrument will wipe out everybody else because of the accumulation. And this is the return feature which the board is trying to capture, to say that then if you have a return like this, it's a liability return. I agree that the focus is on liquidation. This is the what I'm trying to say, what was the concept part behind it. A lot of people has expressed that this may not be the right way to do it. So let us know. That's why it's open. I think the only change we are expecting is cumulatives. But again, as I've been saying, we only know this when the rubber hits the road, when people really try it. So let us know if you think the impact is more than that. That wasn't the intent.
Okay. Ian?
Yeah, I'm just looking at this. I take it this is more disclosure. It's not replacing any old disclosure. It's additional.
Yes, as of now, coupled. Yes, Ian, do let us know.
That point. Yeah.
But you need to make that point also in your letters, because it's an absolutely fair point.
But I think it's the scenario you described is quite legitimate. I think it's. I wonder how this would actually work in practice, because, for example, when we, I'm looking at slide 23, and then what do you mean by capitalization exactly?
The total is just a word that we have taken from the existing information that gives similar, that depicts a similar type of information. So I think we just, it's an example from a like capitalization table, which I mentioned, that some security regulators
require.
I mean,
when we issue debt, we do a cap table. But if I recall, and I didn't look at it recently, but I think in our study, capitalization is something we have to disclose anyway. I mean, it's up to us how we define it, but that's not the same capitalization we're talking about.
No, no. Yeah. So this will just be a grand total of total liability and total equity. So that's what we meant.
We haven't tried to bring in that new concept. No, this is just an example.
You need to sort of be a bit careful. I know, I'm wondering how, for example, we've got a majority-owned subsidiary in Japan, and they issue their own stock options, they issue their own debt. So if you've got sort of a subsidiary issuing their own stuff, I presume that would flow into it.
This is just as an example, but fair point, we'll be careful. I don't want to introduce that new concept as well.
Mm-hmm. Another thing, pretty much all our debt is, our consolidation currency is Swiss francs, and pretty much all our debt is in a different currency. So I guess you... that at the closing spot rate. I wonder
yes,
how
that
much,
would be closing rates.
I can imagine some scenarios I think it could be very useful, but I think it would create a lot of... you have to be careful how you pitch this one. I think it would create a lot of bit of noise.
I think that's where the comments would be really useful, Ian, because given, as Yuni mentioned, the support that we are getting for this kind of data from the users, the more you let us know what could be the pitfalls of these things. For example, to be fair, I've been in outreach where people have said that in certain jurisdictions, this very table is like giving a legal opinion because instruments are not that clear where they stand in the pecking order. Mm-hmm. So one of the points they made is that, am I making a legal commitment as soon as I put it in the financial statements? Most probably you are. Mm-hmm. So valid point, but I think given the... it will help us balance if you let us know what are the challenges so that we can define what could be a realistic way to do this. Because I think given what I've heard from users, as Yuni mentioned, there's quite a bit of appetite for this.
Okay, Parindra.
Yeah, my question was on capitalization, so that has been discussed, the first question. The second question, again, it was touched upon by you. This prioritization is determined by the local laws.
Yep.
Now, so therefore, I presume that an expert certification will be required, because my understanding of prioritization may be disputed later on. So therefore, a safer way for the preparers would be to back it up with an expert. But whether that will be prescribed by the standard setter or not is a question mark.
We won't prescribe it. That much I can tell you right now, Mr. Sanyal. We won't prescribe it.
Just one question. This disclosure will be covered by IFRS 7, I presume.
We haven't decided exactly where to put in terms of which standards.
No, because that is the one meant for disclosures.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I think at some point or the other, you have to say which standard will be covering.
Absolutely.
It will be required for you to do that.
Well, thank you about that if we get enough support.
And the last question is around the third point, the terms and conditions that are relevant to understanding of the timing of the amount feature. Which item are you talking about? All the items in the stable by the side?
Yes, so it will cover all financial liabilities and equity instruments.
So you want,
I think the question arises as to at what level do you do this disclosure? Can you do it? I don't think we are thinking about instrument level disclosure. It will be just too much information. But what is the sensible way to categorize or stratify the instruments into different groups so that these information can be provided in an understandable way, but also within the reasonable volume?
So terms and conditions for example, the secured loan and junior secured loan, and terms and conditions, there could be multiple number of loan instruments.
Yeah, so for an example
disclosure of individual loan condition, terms and conditions, don't you think that it's going to be, some shortcut, some precise way of disclosure have to be given, because it may turn out to be too much of a disclosure.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Questioning the requirement for disclosure, but then I think you are opening up, and if I have, let's say, 50 loan instruments, then, what kind of disclosure shall I make?
When we agree, is a kind of aggregation. Can you do a meaningful aggregation, and we need input how to do that?
It's a level of aggregation question which you're...
Close at 5 after, maybe. We have 3, I think, Christoph, Sandra, and then Richard, and then we will close.
I'll be very brief. You may want to consider how to treat trade payables in this table,
Okay. Because
I think it would be a lot of effort to split trade payables depending on whether it's secured or not, and I don't think that this would provide anyone with a lot of benefit. The cost benefit of getting trade payables in the table may not be given. On the potential dilution, again, the question, would that apply to IFRS 2 instruments as well? I guess it would. Then I think you've got to consider what if the maximum is unlimited, which may well be the case. The theoretical maximum on a share-based compensation feature may be unlimited. Okay. So is that, because the moment we got to estimate what is a reasonable maximum, I think then it's getting really, really difficult. Okay. So if you really want to have maximum, then you say, Could the response be maximum is unlimited? And is that useful information if you say theoretically it's unlimited?
You may want to add a discussion about how to handle corporate separateness in preparing the disclosure and how you communicate that to the users. And I think when you're going through the order of priority, if you give a little bit more robust list of categories so it's clear that it involves all financial instruments,
yeah,
it would be helpful.
Okay. You mentioned corporate separateness.
So if you've got a Thai subsidiary, their debt and their decisions are made by their local management.
So what level and where it is being held.
You've got to respect corporate separateness. You certainly don't have, it doesn't fit in the same priorities of things that might be at your ultimate parent.
Mm. Richard.
I have two comments. One is on this and one's on the previous topic. Would you be putting government liabilities in the table of priority, because they would necessarily...
Government liabilities?
Government. Liabilities of government.
Tax.
No.
It's not a financial instrument, right?
Yes.
And that shouldn't come in.
It's not a financial instrument. It's not a financial instrument, but they might have priority over the...
Yeah.
But we're talking only...
Non-income tax liability is not a financial instrument?
No.
No.
Why is that?
Not contractual.
Non-income tax. Not under IS 12. Non-income tax liability. Why is that not a financial instrument?
What kind of instrument are you talking
property
about?
Tax. I got a property tax liability.
But those it doesn't not... become a non-financial instrument through IS 12 because it's outside the scope of IS 12.
IS 32. I don't want to go into interpreting 32 now, but 32 very clearly says that government and other things are outside the scope of 32. Mm-hmm.
And then on the previous topic, the same economic activity can be configured as a put on a minority interest or a contingent consideration. And under this proposal, they get different accounting treatment.
Mm. I have not thought about that, but if the staff is understanding that.
That's helpful.
Okay, then thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Contributing.
Thanks.
All of the discussion today, and we will now, I think, finish the public meeting. We have any observers? Thank you for coming. And we will now continue with a closed session.